This is Anne reading from the Washington Post on Wednesday, April 8th. Trump agrees to suspend attacks for 2 weeks if Iran opens Strait of Hormuz. By Karen DeYoung, Isaac Arnsdorf, Sammy Westfall, and Tara Kopp. Just 90 minutes before President Donald Trump's 8 p.m. deadline to wipe out a whole civilization with massive strikes on Iran's energy infrastructure and bridges, he granted a 2-week extension for diplomacy to continue. Subject to the Islamic Republic of Iran agreeing to the complete, immediate, and safe opening of the Strait of Hormuz, Trump said Tuesday on social media, "I agree to suspend the bombing and attack of Iran for a period of 2 weeks. We have already met and exceeded all military objectives and are very far along with a definitive agreement concerning long-term peace with Iran," Trump said. "A 10-point proposal received from Tehran," he said, "was a workable basis on which to negotiate." Trump added, "This will be a double-sided ceasefire." After Trump's announcement, a statement posted by Iranian Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi, which he attributed to the Supreme National Security Council, said it too was responding to Pakistan's request and Trump's acceptance of the general framework of Iran's 10-point proposal for negotiations. "If attacks against Iran are halted," it said, "our powerful armed forces will cease their defensive operations." For 2 weeks, it added, safe passage through the Strait of Hormuz will be possible via coordination with the Iranian military. Trump said his ceasefire decision was in response to an appeal from Pakistani Prime Minister Shehbaz Sharif and Military Chief General Asim Unir. Pakistan has led a group of mediators, including Egypt and Turkey, that has been looking for an exit to the war that has destabilized the entire region. Trump has forged a particularly close relationship with Munir and, in an interview with Fox News before the extension announcement, described Sharif as a highly respected man all over. In a statement following Trump's announcement, Sharif said U.S. and Iranian delegations were invited to Islamabad on Friday to further negotiate for a conclusive agreement to settle all disputes. He said that the ceasefire would include Lebanon, where Israel is engaged in a massive bombing campaign against Iran-backed Hezbollah. In a brief statement issued in English by his office early Wednesday local time, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said he supported Trump's decision to suspend strikes against Iran for 2 weeks, subject to Iran immediately opening the straits and stopping all attacks on the U.S., Israel, and countries in the region. Israel also supports the U.S. effort to ensure that Iran no longer poses a nuclear, missile, and terror threat. The United States has told Israel that it is committed to achieving these goals in the upcoming negotiations, Netanyahu said. In a caveat that did not bode well for the negotiations, he added that the ceasefire does not include Lebanon, contradicting Sharif's claims. The Israel Defense Forces said Wednesday it had ceased fire in the campaign against Iran, but would continue its combat and ground operations in Lebanon. Israeli strikes on Lebanon continued through Wednesday morning as the population awoke to confusion over whether the country was included in the deal. The Lebanese army called on people who were eagerly trying to return to their homes in southern Lebanon to delay their return as attacks continued. Hezbollah appeared to be abiding by the agreement, with neither the Iran-backed group or the Israeli military reporting any new attacks on Israel or the Israeli troops invading southern Lebanon. It was not immediately clear how long that would last. In the Persian Gulf, Bahrain reported 2 people were injured following an Iranian drone attack shortly after the ceasefire was announced. Leaders from European and Persian Gulf nations welcomed news of the ceasefire. The European Union's representative for foreign affairs, Kaja Kallas, described it as a step back from the brink after weeks of escalation, while the UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres called on all parties to comply with international law and abide by the terms of the ceasefire in order to pave the way toward a lasting and comprehensive peace in the region. Some U.S. officials and analysts have said Trump's claims of military success are largely based on overly optimistic assessments of the war by Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth, which risk misinforming the public. As recently as last weekend, the two sides appeared at an impasse amid mutually exclusive demands. Iran had rejected U.S. insistence that it shut down its nuclear and ballistic missile programs, ended support for regional proxies, and reopened the strait, the vital Persian Gulf waterway through which an estimated one-fifth of the world's energy supplies transit. In the 10-point proposal, Trump said was a basis for negotiation, Iran demanded a permanent end to the war as well as an end to any attacks against the axis of resistance, as it calls its proxy groups in the region, including Hezbollah. According to a government statement reported by Iranian media late Tuesday, demands also included establishment of a formal protocol for passing through the Strait of Hormuz that ensures an oversight role for Iran. The list called for recognition of Iran's right to uranium enrichment, withdrawal of U.S. combat forces from all bases and military deployment points in the region, full compensation for war damage, the lifting of all sanctions against Iran, and the release of all Iranian assets held abroad. Israel does not share Trump's oft-stated belief that regime change in Iran has already been achieved with the killings of the most of its senior leaders. While Trump has said those now in charge are smarter and less radical than their predecessors, many are considered by experts to be even more hardline. Trump has often referred to the brief U.S. military raid that captured Venezuelan strongman Nicolas Maduro as a template for U.S. action in Iran. After removing its leader in Caracas, Trump left the existing regime in power and now refers to it as a great U.S. partner. If this two-week ceasefire holds with serious talks, one thing is clear, said Aaron David Miller, a veteran of Middle East negotiations through both Republican and Democratic administrations. Regime change is out. Legitimizing this region is in. And the more engagement directly, the more new reality looks more like the old. A brutal, repressive regime has survived the world's most powerful military. While the truce may not sit well with some of the president's most hawkish supporters, and there is no guarantee negotiated agreement with Iran can be reached in the next 2 weeks, Trump has his own reasons for wanting to bring an end to a conflict, including the near doubling of gas prices and a falling approval rating as midterm elections approach. Following the ceasefire announcement, the price of a barrel of oil immediately plunged by about 14% and stock futures surged. Throughout much of Tuesday, an imminent U.S. assault throughout Iran attack appeared certain. Following Trump's apocalyptic threat made early in the morning, Iran said it was calling off talks and threatened a new stage of warfare. As much of the world held its collective breath, countries across the region warned residents to shelter in place. In Washington, Trump's political opponents questioned his fitness for office and called for his removal. While Democratic leaders, lawmakers said Congress should stop the war from escalating Tuesday, Republicans said little. Both former Republican Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene and the NAACP, along with some Democrats, called for Trump's removal through the 25th Amendment to the Constitution, under which the president can be removed from power, including by the vice president and a majority of the cabinet, if they determine him to be unable to discharge the powers and duties of his office. This evil and madness, Green said on X. House Democratic leadership said in a statement that Trump was completely unhinged and called for lawmakers to come back into session immediately and vote on an end to the war. Representative Ted Lieu, California, the number 4 Democrat in House leadership, called on the Pentagon not to obey any orders to eradicate a whole civilization. After the ceasefire announcement, Senate Minority Leader Charles E. Schumer, Democrat, New York, said in a statement he was glad Trump backed off and is desperately searching for any sort of exit ramp from this ridiculous bluster. Trump has claimed to have accomplished regime change in Iran, but regional and Western officials say that the country's hardline government remains largely intact and is prepared to drive a hard bargain in negotiations to end the war, including a demand for full control over the Strait of Hormuz. Haig says boastful claims about Iran war contradict reality, officials say. By John Hudson, Ellen Nakashima, and Tara Kopp. President Donald Trump has continued to describe the war against Iran as an unqualified success, saying as recently as Monday that the United States was doing unbelievably well, while Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth said Tehran had been embarrassed and humiliated by U.S. forces. But Iran's downing of an F-15E fighter jet and the high-risk rescue operation that ensued showed that Tehran retains the ability to threaten the United States' military personnel and cast doubt on the statistics Hegseth has promoted in recent weeks, boasting about complete control of Iranian skies and uncontested airspace, U.S. officials and analysts said. The chaotic but successful rescue mission has become the clearest indication yet that Hegseth's repeated claims of air dominance come with serious caveats and has reinforced concerns inside the Trump administration that his messaging about the war is overly optimistic and risks misinforming both the public and the president. Pete is not speaking truth to the president, one administration official said. As a result, the president is out there repeating misleading information. Though Hegseth has claimed for weeks that Iran has no air defenses and could do nothing about U.S. air incursions, Trump acknowledged during his White House news conference Monday that a shoulder-fired heat-seeking missile downed the F-15 that left two U.S. airmen temporarily stranded deep inside Iranian territory. He got lucky. It was a lucky hit, Trump said. Iran also shot down an A-10 attack plane Friday, though the pilot of that aircraft managed to fly it back to friendly airspace before ejecting safely, officials said. Kelly Grieco, a military analyst at the Stimson Center, said that while the Trump administration has significantly degraded Iran's Navy, Air Force, and fixed missile and radar targets, the F-15's downing is what happens when you have air superiority but don't have air supremacy. Our air superiority is limited geographically to the west and south, but also in terms of altitude, she added, noting that U.S. planes probably have been flying above 15,000 or even 30,000 feet to avoid the type of shoulder-fired rockets that hit the F-15 on Friday. Hegseth's triumphant rhetoric has stood in contrast to that of General Dan Kane, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, who has not suggested U.S. pilots can use Iranian airspace without concern of enemy threats. Pentagon spokesman Sean Parnell called scrutiny of Hegseth's public messaging lies and propaganda. Secretary Hegseth has provided the commander-in-chief with decisive military options to achieve our clear scoped objectives, destroy Iran's missile arsenal, annihilate their navy, destroy their terrorist proxies, and ensure Iran can never obtain a nuclear weapon, he said in a statement. The Washington Post is pushing a fake story of failure. While House spokeswoman Anna Kelly rejected any assertion that Hegseth has misinformed the president and said Trump always knew the Iranians would shoot back, he has always had the full picture of the conflict. Nothing has surprised him or our military planners, who were prepared for any possible contingency, she said. Kelly reiterated that the United States and Israel, its partner in the conflict, have flown more than 13,000 combat flights over Iran, destroyed or damaged two-thirds of Tehran's production facilities, and wiped out Iran's navy. Concerns about Hegseth's war messaging, which comes in the form of televised news conferences and grainy videos of airstrikes posted on his X account, go beyond his claims about U.S. air dominance, said American officials, speaking like some others on the condition of anonymity to discuss sensitive national security matters. A major source of contention, they say, is Hegseth's characterization of the U.S. effort to destroy Iran's vaunted missile and drone programs, the regime's most formidable strike to American Israeli and Arab assets and personnel in the region. Last month, Hegseth said during a Pentagon news conference that Iran's missile and drone programs are being overwhelmingly destroyed. But more than half of the country's missile launchers are still intact, and thousands of one-way attack drones remain in Iran's quiver, according to a recent U.S. intelligence assessment, the contents of which were relayed by three people familiar with the product. The assessment was first reported by CNN. Another source of scrutiny emerged March 31st when Hegseth told reporters the number of Iranian missile and drone launches had fallen to a lower level than any other 24-hour period since the war began. The figure was presented as evidence that relentless U.S. and Israeli strikes were degrading Iran's ability to sustain attacks. But administration officials said Hegseth's claim was incorrect and that lower 24-hour periods occurred March 14th, 15th, and 22nd. Documents sent around internally contradict Hegseth's claims, one official said. Parnell did not address questions about the discrepancy. Open-source data published by Dmitry Alperovich, co-founder of the Silverado Policy Accelerator think tank, also indicated that lower volumes of drone and missile launches occurred in mid-March as opposed to the end of the month. Alperovich aggregates report of launches by governments in the region. Other U.S. officials said Hegseth's focus on launch volume is dubious even if his numbers were close to accurate. If you judge Iran's strength or weakness based on their launch numbers, that is a dumb metric. What is their objective? Are they achieving that? That's what matters, another U.S. official said. That view is echoed by analysts who say Iran's strategy appears to be evolving away from sheer volume of drone and missile strikes toward efficiency and precision. Seven U.S. troops have been killed in Iranian counterattacks, and six others died in an apparent mid-air refueling accident that caused their plane to crash. Nearly 375 other service members have suffered varying degrees of wounds, according to U.S. tallies. Iran's tactics have changed, said one person familiar with U.S. assessments. You saw a bunch of missiles and drone attacks at the start, and then it dropped off precipitously, the person said. That was Iran preserving their magazine. After earlier rounds of attacks by the U.S. and Israel, Iran took actions to protect its missile and drone arsenal to wait out U.S. munition use, this person said. Now our magazine is low on our side, and the Israelis are in the same position. Grieco of the Stinson Center said the focus on Iran's daily launch counts makes a good soundbite but obscures more meaningful indicators. She said Iran's hit rates, the percentage of projectiles that evade defenses and strike targets, have increased over time, according to her analysis of open-source reporting. A high-profile example was that recent destruction of a U.S. E-3 surveillance aircraft in an Iranian strike that hit a U.S. military facility in Saudi Arabia. However, the fact that U.S. forces were able to penetrate deep into Iran for the rescue mission and have everyone come out safe also shows just how much of Iran's capability has been degraded, another U.S. official said. Iran continues to launch ballistic missiles at our partners and allies in the region, said Senator Chris Coons, Democrat, Delaware, a member of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. It continues to lob hundreds of cheap and lethal drones at civilian targets like oil tankers, airports, and hotels, at oil and gas infrastructure, and at our bases and embassies. The United States has taken out Iran's ability to manufacture new ballistic missiles, but it's not possible to wipe out its drone-making capacity, Coons said. You can make a lot of capable and lethal drones in garages and basements and keep firing, Coons said. Iran had thousands of drones before the war, and I've seen nothing to suggest that that stockpile is going away anytime soon. Grieco said Iran appears to be shifting toward a more efficient strategy. They're focusing on smaller, more targeted salvos, she said. They're picking targets and looking for gaps in defenses. Last week, Hegseth went back to the statistics, saying to a news briefing that ballistic missile attacks on U.S. forces are down 90% since the start of the conflict, a metric Trump repeated Monday. While some officials said the president's repetition of Hegseth's rhetoric is concerning, another worry is whether the defense secretary is explaining the evolving complexity of the conflict to Trump. In particular, the stepped-up activities of Iranian-backed groups in the conflict, including Hezbollah in Lebanon and Shiite militias in Iraq, have increased the burden on missile defense systems in the region, scrambling to fend off attack from multiple countries. "You're not just fighting the Iranians," an administration official said. "That hasn't been hammered home." Iranian civilians voice fear and fatigue as U.S. escalates conflict. By Susanna George, Asai Abashin, and Burnham Yukasakis. President Donald Trump has said Iranians welcome expanded U.S. attacks, even as he threatens to destroy key infrastructure and bomb their country back to the Stone Age if Tehran doesn't reopen the Strait of Hormuz by a Tuesday deadline. "All I can tell you is they want freedom. They have lived in a world that you know nothing about. It's a violent, horrible world where if you protest, you are shot," Trump said at a news conference Monday. "They want us to keep bombing." People in Iran say the reality is more complex. Many fear that if the war escalates further, it could wreak long-term havoc on the country's economy, leaving civilians to pay the price. A 27-year-old teacher from Tehran said he almost felt positive about the war when it began with U.S.-Israeli attacks that killed the country's supreme leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei. But as strikes began shifting to economic and industrial targets, the reaction shifted completely, he said, speaking from Qom, having fled the capital. "I felt deeply upset, and so did those around me." Like others in Iran interviewed for this article, he spoke via voice memo shared on a messaging app on the condition of anonymity for fear of reprisal. "It was no longer just about the regime," the teacher said. "These are directly tied to people's lives and the country's economic future. This destruction creates a much deeper sense of insecurity." Nearly 1,500 civilians have been killed since February 28, according to a report released late last month by a consortium of human rights groups, which provided the most comprehensive estimate yet of the war's growing civilian toll. Strikes on infrastructure that could serve both civilian and military needs were among the major factors contributing to the loss of civilian life, the report found. The key point is that infrastructure ultimately constitutes a national asset, one that belongs to the people, not the regime, a 37-year-old factory manager from Tehran said. "Even if we have serious grievances with the government, we cannot, under any circumstances, condone the destruction of infrastructure," the factory manager said. "Such attacks are effectively directed at the population itself." Communicating with people in Iran remains extremely difficult under a near-total government-imposed internet blackout. Those who have managed to stay connected do so with VPNs that allow them to bypass government restrictions and through Starlink internet terminals that connect via satellite and are strictly outlawed in Iran. Trump has twice delayed attacks on Iranian infrastructure, saying he wanted to allow more time for talks. Trump initially threatened to destroy Iranian power plants last month, and since then, Iran and the United States have exchanged messages and positions, according to officials briefed on the mediation efforts, but do not appear to be nearing a deal. Last week, the United States struck a suspension bridge outside Tehran, a move Trump said he ordered after Iran's leaders signaled reluctance to engage in negotiations. Other U.S. and Israeli airstrikes have hit Iranian factories, universities, and medical facilities, including a pharmaceutical production plant and a medical research institute. Iranian state media has reported attacks on a cement factory in southern Iran and two of the country's largest steel plants, Khuzestan Steel Company in the southwest and Mobaraka Steel Company in Isfahan in central Iran. Striking civilian structures, including unfinished bridges, will not compel Iranians to surrender, Iranian Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi posted on social media last week after airstrikes on a suspension bridge west of Tehran caused part of the structure to collapse, killing 8 people, according to local authorities. "It only conveys the defeat and moral collapse of an enemy in disarray. Every bridge and building will be built back stronger," Araghchi added. "What will never recover damage to America's standing." The United States and Israel have launched more than 15,000 airstrikes on Iran since the war began, attacks that forced some Iranians to flee. These strikes had an effect in the opposite way from what was intended. A 50-year-old businessman from the city of Sanandaj in a Kurdish region of western Iran told the Washington Post in an interview last month, just after crossing the border into Turkey. Even the ones who wanted a regime change now say they didn't want this to happen like this. Others at the border crossing described cities that largely continue to function and said even the attacks targeting military sites often injured civilians who happened to be nearby. Tehran is a complex city where military and residential buildings are right next to each other, said a man in his 40s who had just crossed. He said he was an Iranian-Swedish dual citizen. That's why civilian buildings get damaged when a missile targets a military building, so people get injured and go to hospital. As the United States built up forces around Iran earlier this year, some Iranians told the Post they welcomed a possible attack against the Iranian government. Popular expressions of anti-government sentiment have gained intermittent momentum for years. Earlier this year, nationwide protests threw a ferocious government crackdown, which killed thousands of people. Some in Iran saw the start of U.S. and Israeli attacks in late February as another chance for a new government. A 32-year-old importer from Tehran said that after years watching Iran's leadership mismanage the country, the war's physical destruction did not bother him. For me and many young people, there is a sense that these resources were never truly accessible to us, or that their benefits never reached us, the importer said. He said many of his friends and family appear willing to endure greater hardship if it means a chance for lasting change. Some believe that everything should be torn down and rebuilt, even if the cost is high, he said. A 45-year-old actor from Tehran said, when the war began, there was a brief wave of elation after he learned that Khamenei had been killed on the first day of the conflict. He said the shock from hearing of Khamenei's death was so great he felt like that moment would mark an ending of some kind. But no one expected the situation to drag on like this, to become so prolonged and exhausting, he said. That initial feeling quickly gave way to fatigue, a deep collective exhaustion. Fearful that conditions in the capital could quickly deteriorate, the actor fled to a city north of Tehran for the first few weeks of the war. But after hearing reports of heavy damage near his home, he decided to return to see for himself. They said the destruction was extensive, but I didn't truly understand what extensive meant until I returned, he said. When I came back to Tehran, I didn't recognize the city. The number of destroyed buildings was beyond what he had imagined, and even in places where there wasn't as much physical destruction, he said he felt a profound shift in the city's energy. We are tired, he said, and we truly do not believe that anything good will come out of this foreign attack. What spending probes the DHS reveal about Kristi Noem's time in office? By Brianna Sachs, Maria Sacchetti, and Marianne Levine. On a Monday in mid-March, a group of Department of Homeland Security investigators entered the Federal Emergency Management Agency's headquarters and headed up to the eighth floor past two access control doors into an office near the administrators. The agents roped off the area, copied notebooks left on the desk, and put stacks of documents and equipment in boxes. That workspace belonged to an influential figure at DHS who had been integral to overseeing much of FEMA's day-to-day operations, including decisions on grants and awards that are now part of an Office of Inspector General review of contracts issued under then-Secretary Kristi L. Noem's leadership, according to several current and former DHS officials, including two with knowledge of the headquarters search. Kara Voorhees joined DHS early in Trump's second term and worked closely with Noem's top aide, Corey Lewandowski, as a contractor. Both held unusual roles at DHS that stationed them at the top echelons of the agency and put them at the center of some of its most controversial and consequential moves over the past year. Last June, Noem demanded that DHS headquarters approve all contracts worth more than $100,000, giving top officials significant control over everyday spending and creating major delays. Noem's successor, Secretary Mark Wayne Mullen, has swiftly scrapped that rule and said leadership should review contracts valued at more than $25 million, a cap that he called appropriate. Among the awards that have come under public scrutiny are $1 billion contract fast-tracked to a pro-Trump donor last year, a $200 million contract to purchase two private jets for Noem and other top officials to use for travel, and another $200 million contract for ads that Noem starred in last year. Senator Richard Blumenthal, Democrat, Connecticut, said that the Senate Permanent Subcommittee on Investigations is conducting a probe of potential wrongdoing by Lewandowski and Noem in connection with DHS contracts. He said he is also aware of information indicating that the DHS Office of Inspector General is investigating the handling of grants and contracts by Noem, Lewandowski, and others. The DHS Inspector General's office declined to comment on a probe, saying it has a long-standing policy neither to confirm or deny the existence of any specific investigation. The Washington Post reviewed emails, meeting records, and memos from the past year and spoke with more than 12 current and former DHS and FEMA officials, including several senior officials who spoke on the condition of anonymity because of the sensitivity of the matter. The review offers a rare inside window on the power wielded by Lewandowski and a handful of advisors, Voorhees chief among them, while Noem led the agency. The Wall Street Journal and CNN first reported details about the investigation and Voorhees' outsized influence on FEMA as a shadow administrator. The Post is reporting previously unpublicized details about Voorhees' role within FEMA. Voorhees worked in lockstep with the U.S. DOGE service, the government cost-cutting operation headed by Elon Musk, for a time, according to one senior official, and enforced priorities such as canceling grants that mentioned climate change, social media, diversity, equity, or inclusion. She also worked to ensure that Muslim groups did not receive security grants and participated in high-level conversations trying to block California from getting any money because of its status as a sanctuary state. Inside FEMA, concerns grew as Voorhees was given broad authority over spending, taking the lead on grants even over the agency's own grants manager. She also had access to proprietary information, including details about large contracts and planned projects. Many people who worked with Voorhees at FEMA did not know she was a contractor, several former senior officials said, despite federal regulations that require contractors to clearly identify themselves as such in conversations, in meetings, and on emails. In 20 years, I have never seen this done, said one former senior official. This was a huge shift. Voorhees did not respond to requests for comment. DHS and Noem did not respond to a list of questions. In a statement provided by an intermediary, Lewandowski's office said he never benefited personally from DHS contracts. The office indicated that he had helped to implement reforms that saved American taxpayers $15 billion and said that his critics include entrenched interests that opposed those reforms. Contracting decisions rest with authorized officials at DHS, Lewandowski's office said. During Mr. Lewandowski's voluntary tenure at DHS cutting waste, fraud, and abuse, Mr. Lewandowski did not solicit nor has he been compensated by companies in any way, shape, or form. Last spring, Voorhees seemed to appear out of nowhere. Suddenly, according to a former senior agency official, she was in FEMA meetings that should have been government only and that were mostly focused on the agency's budget. At the time, the former official said agency staffers were scrambling to justify every penny of contracts and grants as the U.S. DOGE service carried out a major overhaul of the federal government. It was quickly understood that Voorhees was Lewandowski's eyes and ears, the senior official said, and we were told to give her access to whatever she wanted. before he set up processes to manually review every grant and contract that FEMA had already awarded, and she gave direction on which ones to cancel, according to two current and three former senior officials. The grant review process was chaotic and frustrating, they said, and sparked multiple lawsuits and delays in dispersing funds across the agency. Voorhees was known for enforcing NOM's $100,000 rule for reviewing contracts, and as a contractor, she should not have been given wide latitude on matters such as personnel decisions and spending during and after natural disasters, according to three former FEMA officials and one senior FEMA official. She previously worked for financial consulting firms and had no known prior experience in emergency management. Many of the instructions Voorhees gave reflected Noem and Lewandowski's political agenda, nearly a dozen former and current FEMA officials said. California came up often as a target, particularly in connection with the Urban Area Security Initiative, which FEMA manages. Lewandowski and Voorhees were involved in discussions about how to withhold money from the state because it provides protections for undocumented immigrants, and said two former senior officials. Voorhees also helped delay grants that went out to nonprofits and religious organizations, according to the two former officials in emails reviewed by the Post. She was heavily involved in ensuring that money for a security grant program at first went only to Jewish organizations, the official said, after DOGE provided FEMA a list of Muslim groups with supposed terrorist ties. The list came from an outside organization, which one former senior official said FEMA had never relied on before. Eventually, the federal money also went to Muslim organizations. In June, Voorhees became involved in a multimillion-dollar project that DHS ordered FEMA to rapidly pull together, the creation of an immigration detention facility in South Florida that became known as Alligator Alcatraz. Noem had traveled to Florida to help orchestrate the deal, said a former senior official with direct knowledge of the situation. FEMA staff was told to design a grant that would enable the department to pay Florida to erect and run the migrant center by restructuring the agency's shelter and services program, according to the official and pages of the plan reviewed by the Post. While FEMA acting administrator David Richardson played key role in the process, Voorhees provided employees with lots of direction and drove many of the conversations and even approvals on what we were doing, according to the former senior official with direct knowledge of the situation. The official described how Voorhees would tell employees as well as some FEMA lawyers what they needed to do and how to do it. FEMA officials were irked by her involvement and became concerned again a month later when she had a hand in allocating resources after the July 4 floods in Texas. As federal and local teams worked to send technical assistance to search and rescue crews, Voorhees was one of the people who questioned the need for those resources, according to a senior official. Once the urgency was explained, Voorhees said others enabled a request for help to go up the chain to Lewandowski and on to Noem, who rapidly approved it. It was getting through everyone, a.k.a. Carrot, to get to Noem, the official said. That was the problem. As concern grew inside the agency, outside it, Noem was drawing attention to DHS by pushing through controversial policies that sparked protests, lawsuits, and violent confrontations in cities around the United States. 2 months after Trump's inauguration, she signed off on sending three planes filled with Venezuelan and Salvadoran men, whom the administration accused of being gang members, to a notorious prison in El Salvador. Then she visited the terrorism confinement center herself and posed for photos before detainees while sporting a $50,000 Rolex watch. In the months that followed, Noem dispatched thousands of officers to Democratic-led cities where they shot and killed three people, including two U.S. citizens. ICE detention numbers soared to record levels as immigration officers began picking up more people, many with no criminal record. Noem defended those actions as necessary for national security, and a spokeswoman said the watch was purchased using proceeds from Noem's book sales. By the fall, Noam's use of government resources was also making headlines. In October, the Post reported that the Coast Guard was planning to buy two Gulfstream private jets to be used by Noam and other top DHS and Coast Guard officials at a total estimated cost of $200 million. Noam was also living rent-free at a home reserved for the Coast Guard's top admiral. DHS later said she had begun paying to reside there. DHS had also fast-tracked a contract worth almost $1 billion to Salus Worldwide Solutions, according to records reviewed by the Post. The company is led by William Walters, a donor to pro-Trump nonprofit group. The contract involved DHS program called Project Homecoming that offers cash bonuses, free flights, and a concierge service at airports for departing migrants. According to a lawsuit from a competing company challenging the award, as well as an official familiar with the process, DHS officials shared non-public information with Salus to help prepare its bid, prompting an investigation by agency lawyers. An internal investigation found that DHS employees exchanged at least 40 emails with Salus to discuss the contract and determined that Salus had an unfair advantage in helping to design the contract it bid on, the competing company said in a December 2nd court filing. In an email to the Post that month, a lawyer for Salus denied that the company received inside information. Representative Robert Garcia, Democrat, California, sent a letter to Walters last week as part of a House Oversight and Government Reforms Committee investigation into potential corruption, self-dealing, and mismanagement at DHS under Noam and Lewandowski's leadership. He requested that Walters share records of all interactions between Salus and Lewandowski, among other documents. Every day we find new evidence that corruption tied to Corey Lewandowski runs deep inside the Department of Homeland Security, Garcia said in a statement. Our taxpayer dollars may have been diverted to pay off connected insiders on a massive scale. Voorhees and Lewandowski continued to play high-profile roles in DHS even as concerns grew. During the State of the Union address, Voorhees was among a small group of DHS leaders allowed to depart to Virginia in a helicopter meant for high-ranking officials and support staff. The chopper may have intruded on restricted airspace near the Capitol, according to two officials with direct knowledge of the situation, alerting security personnel. Voorhees' name was on the manifest beforehand, but people had no idea she was a contractor and not a government employee until there was an issue with the flight path, said one official. She should never have been on that aircraft, that official said. The Inspector General launched an audit in January of DHS grants and contracts awarded by any means other than full and open competition during fiscal 2025. But in a letter to Senate and House appropriators, Inspector General Joseph Kaffari wrote that DHS had systematically obstructed his office's work and that the obstruction was particularly egregious in a specific pending criminal investigation. Kaffari did not offer specific details about the investigation, but he wrote that another federal law enforcement agency had asked his office to join a criminal inquiry when his office requested access to a DHS database, Kaffari said. The department imposed conditions that could compromise the investigation. Days before her firing, Noam faced contentious oversight hearings in the House and the Senate, where lawmakers asked her about the agency's contracting process and the Inspector General's letter. Does anybody have any idea how bad it has to be for the OIG in this agency to come out and do this publicly? Senator Tom Tillis, Republican, North Carolina, asked at a Senate Judiciary Committee hearing. That is stonewalling. That's a failure of leadership. And that is why I've called for your resignation. During the same hearing, Senator John Neely, Kentucky, Republican, Louisiana, Kennedy, Republican, Louisiana, pressed Noam on the $200 million ad contract that DHS had fast-tracked early in her tenure as secretary. When asked if Trump had approved the ad campaign, Noam replied that the agency went through the legal processes and claimed Trump knew ahead of time. Kennedy replied, "It puts the president in a terribly awkward spot." Noam also denied that Lewandowski played a role in approving contracts. During a House Judiciary Committee hearing the following day, Noem maintained that the Inspector General has been told repeatedly in writing, verbally, on the phone, that he can have access to anything at the Department of Homeland Security. He just needs to provide a scoping memo, Noem said. He wants unfettered access to every single thing in the department, and that's not the process. In late March, Ghaffari wrote to Blumenthal that his department's audit of spending under Noem had stopped for another reason, the partial DHS shutdown. We will resume our audit upon the cure in funding, he wrote, and would welcome the opportunity to brief you on our findings once it is complete. Epic winter drought creates a bleak situation for farmers and your food. By Sarah Kaplan. Justin Perry's family has been farming the rolling hills of the Nebraska Panhandle for four generations, but none of them can remember a winter as warm and parched as this one. There was no steady rain to gently soak the soil, no blanket of snow to insulate the fields and pasture, just warm, dry winds that swept across the landscape, sucking moisture from every inch of exposed earth. Now spring has arrived, along with forecasts for continued drought that could imperil Perry's winter wheat and summer planting. An extraordinary March heat wave sent temperatures soaring to almost 90 degrees, further baking the soil. And to the north, Perry can see smoke billowing from record-setting wildfires that have consumed hundreds of thousands of acres of ranches and farmland. This is feeling really bleak, Perry said. This might be one of those scenarios that breaks some guys. All across the lower 48, farmers like Perry are reeling from the hottest and third driest September to February stretch on record. As of March 31st, the last date for which data is available, nearly 60% of the U.S. was in drought, according to the U.S. Drought Monitor. With the exception of the Midwest's sprawling corn and soybean farms, the dire conditions encompass many of the regions that grow the country's food, from peanuts in the south to wheat and cattle in the Great Plains to produce in the southwest. If the combination of rainfall shortage and unprecedented heat continues, experts say, it could have ripple effects through the nation's food supply, with some products like beef already projected to see prices surge. We're in a position here where we're going into the growing season and into the spring with record low or near record low soil moisture across the country, said Agriculture Department meteorologist Brad Rippey. Things are bad and getting worse in a hurry. Some of the driest conditions are in the south, where the growing season is well underway. More than three-quarters of sugarcane-producing areas, 83% of rice-producing areas, and a whopping 96% of the peanut-producing region is besieged by drought. Unseasonable winter warmth, punctured by an unusual February freeze, also caused damage to many fruit trees in the region. These occasional cold bursts, caused by waviness in the jet stream that allows Arctic air to plunge south, have become more frequent in recent decades, Rippey said. When we have early warm spells that push crop development along, the cold air is just lurking, and it doesn't take much to unleash it, he said. The extraordinarily hot and dry conditions spell trouble for the nation's breadbasket in the Great Plains. Early spring is typically when farmers apply fertilizer to winter wheat, a hardy grain that is planted in the fall and harvested during the summer. But the severity of this year's drought has growers questioning whether they should keep investing in a crop that may not survive or cut their losses and replant with something else. Meanwhile, extremely dry soil makes it more difficult for new seeds to germinate. It's another gamble, frankly, Perry said. Because wheat is a globally traded commodity, the failed crop in the plains is just one small contributor to the cost of bread, said Jennifer Ift, a professor of agricultural economics at Kansas State University. And prices won't necessarily fluctuate as a result of one bad U.S. season. Other global factors such as Russia's invasion of Ukraine and high fuel prices stemming from the conflict in the Middle East can also have a powerful effect on costs. But Americans will probably feel the effects of the drought when shopping for beef, which is mostly produced domestically. The number of cattle raised in the United States is already the lowest since the 1950s, a consequence of 2022-2023 dry spell that reduced forage and raised hay prices across the high plains. This year, according to the Agriculture Department, 64% of the U.S. cattle inventory is affected by drought, along with most of the hay and alfalfa used for feed. This gives ranchers no reason to regrow their herds and may prompt them to sell off even more animals, leading to high prices for people at the grocery store, said Ariel Ortiz Bobia, an economist at Cornell University. The cost of beef has already increased 14.4% since February 2025 and is projected to rise an additional 10% by the end of the year. Perry, whose pastures feed his 100-cow herd as well as cattle he takes in from other farmers, said his drought-depleted grass represents a major math problem. I've shifted my mindset on cattle side of things to be less focused on how many calves can I grow and sell and more on how much grass can I grow, he said. Farther west, where most farmland is irrigated, it is the dwindling mountain snowpack that has produces most alarmed. The amount of moisture stored in snow, a metric known as snow water equivalent, was already close to record lows when a historic heat dome engulfed much of the region in March. The surge of summer-like warmth caused a precipitous drop in mountain snowpacks, said Jason Gerlich, the regional drought early warning system coordinator for the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. In the Cascade Mountains of the Pacific Northwest, 30 inches of snow water equivalent disappeared in a matter of days. The Arkansas Red River Basin, which stretched from Colorado to the Mississippi River, contains just 8% of its average snowpack moisture. There is simply no analogous years to this one, Gerlich said. These conditions bear unmistakable fingerprints of caused climate change, scientists say. Higher temperatures allow the atmosphere to hold more water vapor, pulling moisture out of soils and plants. This phenomenon leads to longer and more intense dry spells, as well as more severe storms that drop huge amounts of rain faster than the landscape can absorb it. The effects could be particularly severe for irrigated farms, which account for the majority of human water consumption in the American West. Water in the region is governed by seniority. Those who most recently got that rights to use water are the first to lose access during times of drought. In Washington's Yakima River Basin, now facing a record fourth consecutive year of drought, anyone whose water rights were issued less than 1905 will receive just 44% of the usual entitlement, according to a March announcement from the U.S. Bureau of Reclamation. Junior rights holders along other rivers, including the hotly contested Colorado, could face similar cutbacks in the coming months. Anticipation of those cuts is affecting how Western farmers plan for the year, said Lauren Reese, executive director of Colorado's Water Conservation Board. Folks that know they're in the bullseye are likely going to start to consider operations that would fallow fields or leave acres unplanted or shorter season crops that could make most of water while we have it, she said. Produce growers in Arizona, who hold some of the most junior water rights on the Colorado River, could face cutbacks of 30 to 50% of the usual supply. These farmers provide about 90% of America's leafy greens between the months of November and April. The impact of a drought here do not stop at the state line, reset. The National Weather Service forecasts that these hot, dry conditions will persist or deepen across most of the South and West this spring. For farmers, the stresses of drought are likely to be compounded by the war with Iran, which has caused a spike in prices for fuel and fertilizer. You are at the mercy of the weather, the market, geopolitics, said Ift, the Kansas State professor. It's like getting kicked when you're down. Most U.S. farmers are well covered by crop insurance, which can act as a safety net through one or two bad seasons, she added. Meanwhile, the complexity of the global food market can buffer consumers from drought-induced price increases. If Arizona farmers can't grow as much lettuce, for example, producers in California and Mexico may be able to fill the gap. but the persistently high prices for beef illustrate the consequences of prolonged repeated dry spells, Ortiz Bobilla said. If farmers endure too many bad years back-to-back, they may change their practices or stop producing altogether. Eventually, grocery shoppers will also feel the squeeze. Already, the effects of the U.S. drought are reflected in international wheat prices, which have increased 4.3% in the past month, according to the UN Food and Agriculture Organization. Rising global temperatures will make devastating weather patterns far more common, researchers say. In a 2021 study in the journal Nature Climate Change, Ortiz Bobilla found that human-caused warming has already reduced global agricultural productivity by more than 20%, with even worse effects in warmer regions. Farmers have been able to mitigate that headwind with improved technology and more sophisticated practices, he said, but that won't always be the case. In Nebraska, Perry said his family has sought to cope with high prices and harsh weather by adopting more sustainable practices. They are using less fertilizer on crops like wheat and corn and have stopped tilling their soil to help preserve its moisture. We're doing the best we can to grow a safe and healthy food supply, he said, but I'm seeing less opportunities for profitability the longer this extends. Bill Gates to speak to House panel about ties to Jeffrey Epstein by Mariano Alfaro and Megan Vasquez. Bill Gates, the billionaire co-founder of Microsoft, will appear before a House committee June 10th to discuss his connection to the convicted sex offender Jeffrey Epstein, according to two people familiar with the committee's scheduling. The Republican-led House Oversight Committee is looking into the Justice Department's investigation of the deceased financier. In March, the committee wrote to Gates requesting that he testify about his connection to Epstein. The businessman was among seven people called to testify before the panel. Gates, a former associate of Epstein's, is pictured in photographs and named in files related to the late financier. The tech mogul has said that he regrets meeting with Epstein, calling his relationship with the sex offender, which began after Epstein was convicted of sex crimes, a huge mistake. Gates welcomes the opportunity to appear before the committee, a spokesman said. While he never witnessed or participated in any of Epstein's illegal conduct, he is looking forward to answering all the committee's questions to support their important work. That is all the time we have for today. This is Anne saying goodbye, and I'll talk with you again soon.